Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Two changes to Vermont healthcare regulations may make it easier for trans and non-binary young people in Vermont to access gender-affirming surgery if it's deemed medically necessary. Several young people trying to get surgery before the age of 21 have struggled to get coverage for their medical care, and these changes would require insurance carriers to cover the treatment. We're going to go deeper into medical care for trans and non-binary young people in a little while, but first we want to make sure we get the specifics of these changes. So we are joined by Barb Prine, a staff attorney with Vermont Legal Aid's Disability Law Project. Barb Prine has represented several Vermonters seeking to get their gender-affirming surgery covered by Medicaid. Welcome back to the program. Nice to talk with you.
You know,
we're looking at this question of medical care in general for people who are trans and non-binary, who are young, who are trying to get medical coverage in all different forms for their treatment, for their lives. And one of these is, of course, the potential for surgery. And so we wanted to talk with you about these changes because the changes impact the ability for people to get surgery and get it covered by insurance, which is, of course, cost is a huge barrier to care. So let's talk about these two changes first and what they each say and then what impact they may have on Vermonters. So can you talk first about the change that if for private insurers, this is a change in wording that the state has made, but it seems like it could potentially be an important change in wording.
Yes. So in Vermont, we have the Department of Financial Regulation, and one of the things that they do is regulate insurance companies. Our Vermont legislature decided 12 years ago that it was illegal to discriminate based on gender identity. And the Department of Financial Regulation clarified in 2013 that that applies to healthcare too, that healthcare companies can't refuse to provide medically necessary transgender surgery and care. Well, very recently, this summer, the Department of Financial Regulation clarified that that also applies to transgender youth, that health insurance companies can't refuse to provide medically necessary health care for young people who are transgender. So the surgeries and the treatments that youth need for their transgender care also can't be denied by health insurance companies because of age. They can require that the people prove it's medically necessary, but they can't say, I'm sorry, you're 17. We're not going to provide this care.
And the thinking is that putting an age limit on it is a sort of an arbitrary barrier to care, that the age has nothing to do with the medical care received, so it shouldn't be something that the health insurers can limit by that age?
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think there are developmental reasons, and I think some of your other speakers will address that about when different therapies become appropriate, but it isn't for the insurance company to set cutoffs traditionally that have been 21. To providing medically necessary care, which is really life-saving care.
So that's a state language change that applies to private insurers operating within the state of Vermont. There's also a pending change to Medicaid. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So Vermont Medicaid has had a transgender surgery policy that is they're updating, and it's a proposed policy change. And the old rules were really based on old ideas and not current best practices. One of the problems in the old rules is that they were extremely burdensome for the medical providers to prove certain things that were not related to whether or not something was medically necessary. So there are really three sets of changes that are happening. One is that the medical system for all ages needs to prove medical necessity, but not in sort of these tightly prescribed ways. Like one of the things is like letters had to be written by someone who was a PhD level provider, where most people's mental health providers are master's degree social workers. The second change is that in the past, Medicaid only provided transgender surgeries to people over 21, and that rule is being eliminated to developmentally appropriate care. And the third is Vermont Medicaid required a lot of documentation that had nothing to do with the need for transgender surgery, like chest photos or documentation that you'd educated your family or that you've worked on your interpersonal and workplace issues. Like, those things aren't related to medically necessary health care. So those barriers have been eliminated.
And in practice, it was difficult for people to access surgery when they had to sort of jump through hoops for things like having hormone therapy for at least a year, but you couldn't get the hormone therapy that you needed if you were under the age of 21. So how could you possibly have gotten the surgery? You know, there were like these steps as well that may have made it difficult for people to access the care that their doctors and their medical team is saying is medically necessary.
And that is completely true. Many people had to go through appeal processes where they had administrative hearings, where they had to discuss very personal issues to prove their need for care. And when we're talking about medical necessity here, we're really talking about anxiety, depression, suicidality, like the letters that you get from these healthcare professionals about how crippling gender dysphoria can be were just heartbreaking. And people were really having to expose themselves in ways that we don't really put any other kind of health care through.
You know, when you talk about that, we got a note from Scott on Facebook who says, if one wants this type of surgery or this type of medical care, it should be on their own nickel. Why is it, you know, why have you been advocating? This is not a change necessarily to surgical rules, to medical rules. This is a change to insurance coverage. Why is it important for insurance companies to cover this kind of medical care?
It's important for insurance companies to cover this kind of medical care because insurance companies are in the business of providing care, paying for care that's been determined to be medically necessary. And when you take one kind of care and say, we're not going to provide that, even though your health care providers, multiple health care providers have told this is medically necessary, we're just not going to believe you because you have because you're transgender, that is flat-out discrimination. And in Vermont, that's illegal. And that's why these rules had to change.
And you have represented people who have been seeking to get their gender-affirming surgery covered by Medicaid. I mean, that's part of what prompted these rule changes.
Yeah. And part of what prompted the rule changes is that Vermont's rules, as they stood, you know, violated federal law, and we were winning these individual cases. And really, to Vermont Medicaid's credit, they listened and they made changes that are really going to be much better and much more in line with best practices.
Were insurance carriers, both private and government run, not covering surgery? I mean, in some cases, they were, right?
So, within the health insurance industry, some insurance companies were doing a pretty good job, and some insurance companies were just flat out denying it, particularly with the age for under 21. And for Vermont Medicaid, we would represent people in appeals, and we were consistently winning those appeals, but it was a very raw and exposed process for a person to have to go through to get the medically necessary care.
Do you know how many people these rule changes will affect in a given year in Vermont?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I have heard that it's not that, you know, there are not that many people who seek gender-affirming care, but I don't know the numbers.
How different do you think this will make in terms of access for people who need to have this type of surgery? Because even if insurance covers it, as we know, depending on someone's insurance coverage, you may still be out of pocket several thousand dollars before you hit your deductible. So, you know, is this giving access to people for this type of medical care, or, you know, are there still barriers?
Well, I mean, cost is the biggest problem, and that's why we need single-payer health care where our health care access is like our access to public schools. You go there and you get what you need. But stepping aside from that, cost can be a huge barrier to people for copays and deductibles, but really the cost for this surgery should be like all other surgeries. Transgender health care should be no more nor no less burdensome than all the other health care we get. It should be, you know, just as much of a drag on your wallet as your appendicitis or your knee surgery or anything else that you have to get.
Barb, before we let you go, these two rule changes, are they in effect? I know that the state has made the change in its language to clarify for private insurance carriers, but and the Medicaid one is still pending. Do you have a sense of when each of these go into effect?
So the one that says that all health insurance companies, and that all health insurance companies also does include Vermont Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
That one went into effect June 12th of this year. Vermont Medicaid's rules, they're still in the public comment process, and when that's completed, it has to go before the Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules before they're finalized. So it's going to be probably 2 to 3 more months.
Barb Prine is a staff attorney with Vermont Legal Aid's Disability Law Project. She has represented several Vermonters seeking to get their gender-affirming surgery covered by Medicaid. Barb, thanks very much for talking with us about these rule changes.
Thank you very much for covering this important topic.
As we just discussed, some of the rules in Vermont are in the process of changing to make sure that age is not a barrier when it comes to accessing gender-affirming medical care, specifically surgery. A change has already been made to the state language that applies to how private insurers and all insurers can operate in Vermont. The requirement to cover gender affirmation surgery was added several years ago, and the language now says, quote, in addition, insurers may not deny coverage of gender affirmation surgery as not medically necessary on the basis of age without other clinical factors or circumstances supporting the decision. That rule change, combined with a pending change to Medicaid coverage, could make it easier for Vermonters under the age of 21 to have insurance coverage for surgery. But of course, surgery is only one type of medical care related to gender for trans and non-binary people. We're going to broaden our scope now to talk about access to care in general. Aaron Young is a senior at South Burlington High School. He began his transition when he was 13, and he had a mastectomy in April as part of his ongoing medical care. Aaron, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here.
Leo Klein is a certified nurse practitioner working at the BU Clinic at the Community Health Centers of Burlington. The clinic has LGBTQ knowledgeable providers, nurses, and social workers for needs ranging from primary care for LGBTQ individuals and families to gender-affirming care for those interested in transitioning. Leo, it's a pleasure to have you on the show as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Aaron, can you talk a little bit about the topic that we've been talking about earlier, this question of young people accessing surgical care? And the rule changes are, of course, related to insurance coverage. But how do you think about it when you relate it to your own personal experience?
Well, some of the biggest struggles being a young person looking for any kind of affirming treatment, whether that's hormones or surgery, the first question you're always asked is, you know, how old are you? Because a lot of individual practices will have a kind of ballpark range of, well, we like to start when you're around 16. Cause it's
start what? Care or?
Care, usually. Of like really things that are going to change you, like hormone surgery,
mm-hmm.
Just for the sake of, you know, not wanting to push, you know, really life altering things onto young children. And another thing that can be really challenging for kids like me who only live with one parent is very often you will need a signature from both parents in order to continue that process.
You know, no matter what kind of conversation older people are having with younger people, often it comes down to, oh, you don't know what's best for you yet. You're just a kid. And wait until you're an adult if you want to do things. I mean, and, you know, that applies from everything from ear piercing to, you know, gender affirmation surgery or,
yeah,
or you know, so when you think about, first of all, you are a young person. Your brain is still developing. Your idea of self is still developing. But also, you know who you are and you know what your needs are. How do you think about that question of young people really being advocates for their own care?
Well, I think it's really important to let the, you know, main decision be, you know, for the person. I think it is, you know, important when you're talking to anybody young who wants to, you know, make a life decision to talk about, okay, why do you want to make that decision? And, like, what are your goals? Just to kind of, you know, because sometimes as a young person, it can be hard to really rationalize an idea of this is why I want to do this and this is how I want it to turn out. It can be helpful to have adults to help you with that.
Have you been really clear on your gender since you were a kid?
I have not actually. I, up until I was 12 or 13, I was very happily a pretty girly girl. I loved having long hair. I loved wearing makeup. Dresses were never my thing, but that's just because – no, thank you. They're hard. I like pants. But I then at about 13, I discovered the internet, which is something that a lot of young people use to discover labels and communities that feel right. And I spent quite a few months kind of playing around with labels, trying to figure out what felt good. Nothing ever really felt like, yeah, I like that one. So one day I reached out to three of my closest friends and said, hey, I'm kind of trying to figure things out. Do you think you could use this name and he, him pronouns for me just for a few weeks, see how that feels? And once people started using that, I was like, yeah, that feels right.
And you've never wavered from that since?
I have never wavered since.
And the decision to get surgery, what did you have to go through to think through whether that was right for you and whether it was right for you now?
Well, before we even really started talking about surgery, I had been on hormones for a little over a year. Because, you know, when you change the hormones that are in your body, it changes, like, the fat distribution. It moves things to different places. So we were going to see, like, you know, if you put a binder on after a year of testosterone, is that going to give you what you want? Or do we still need to do more?
And a binder, of course, is to bind your breasts so
right.
That they're not as apparent. But
yes.
But obviously your breasts are still there.
Yes, your breasts are still there. And sadly, one of the things that us as humans tend to look at for an identifier is breasts to figure out, okay, what should I call you? And that's just something we've been conditioned to do. But as a trans person, that can be very uncomfortable. So I, you know, when I was comfortably being a girl, I was okay with having breasts because I was okay being like a sexual girl. But, you know, once I decided to really start living as a boy, I was like, they weren't part of me anymore. And I was like, let's just get these off. Like, I would have loved to give them to somebody else who wanted them. But,
very,
you know,
kind of
an option.
That's Aaron Young, a senior at South Burlington High School, talking about his own experience. Leo Klein, as we mentioned, is a nurse practitioner working at the BU clinic at the Community Health Centers of Burlington. Leo, do you talk with young people who are struggling to get the kind of medical care that they need, whether it's actual access to care or getting medical professionals and adults to trust what they're saying about what they need?
Absolutely. So I do have a specialty clinic that's the BU clinic, and that welcomes people who are LGBTQ. But I also see these individuals throughout my clinical day all week long, and folks will come in seeking affirmative care and initially just hoping to have someone who can hear them and show up for them in a way that maybe parents or you know, teachers at school or whoever it is that's theoretically their support system may not actually be able to do for them. So the initial step is just listening and trying to understand what's going on for that person. And oftentimes there's a lot that's brought them through the door. So there's a lot of pre-work that has happened that's made it absolutely necessary for them to finally speak with me or some of my colleagues. So I would say that there's often this sense that people rush into treatment, or there's a fear that children or youth will rush into treatment. And I think that's very rarely the case, because not only are we making sure that we're providing a really safe space to thoroughly discuss the entire topic and all of the impacts this could have on their life, but also the person themselves has typically put themselves through a lot of inner turmoil to get to the point of saying, I absolutely have to talk to someone about this.
And then beyond talking, how do you help them find access to the right forms of medical care?
So I can offer a lot of the medical care that youth would be seeking. And we also have community resources that can offer them things that I do not offer. So one notable medical intervention would be hormone blockers, which oftentimes if a person is quite young, so let's say 12, 13, the recommendation would be to go on hormone blockers to sort of buy them a little bit of time while they're making some really big decisions and while their family is potentially grappling with that, but to not bring about the secondary sex characteristics that would happen naturally if they didn't have that pause button.
Right. These blockers essentially delay puberty and the changes that come along with it, the physical changes.
Exactly. And so it just buys that person a little bit of time to sort out exactly what they want without having any detriment from it. So they're not used long term. They're used temporarily until a plan is made. And I will just take a moment to say that making that plan with the person as the sort of central figure, and then the family as the support system who's kind of like helping put that into place, just the planning phase of things can be incredibly reassuring and affirming to an individual. And I feel, sort of as Barb mentioned before, life-saving, because these are individuals who, if they don't have that support, they can feel incredibly isolated. And that can lead to all sorts of negative sequela, such as depression, anxiety, self-harm, using substances. We've had teens that have killed themselves for not, you know, simply not having a space to be themselves.
So our listener who I mentioned before, who wrote in to say, you know, this should be on somebody else's dime, they should do it themselves. If this is the kind of medical treatment that they want, you don't see it that way.
Absolutely not. I don't think you would see it that way if somebody had depression. You wouldn't say, I'm sorry, you can't get your antidepressants, you can't seek help from a psychiatrist, you can't have the support that you need to get back on your feet. You would never say that.
We have listeners who are questioning this question about surgery for young people specifically. And so, Leo, I'd love for you to go through some of the ideas around medical best practices. Mm-hmm. And then, Aaron, you can jump in as well if you want.
For sure.
But so first of all, Dave writes, shouldn't people be required to try other treatments first before surgery? And Dave cites a report about regret over surgery, saying it's not uncommon, could be increasing, doesn't seem to be something that doctors are tracking. And Steve says, I think it's dangerous to treat children in this manner because many people struggle with sexuality well into their teen years. So what about this idea that I think people are equating a rule change about when surgery is covered with some change in ideas about how many young people should be having surgery? Mm-hmm. Surgery is not usually the first step.
Absolutely not. No, it's typically something that's discussed years into a person's transition, and it's very carefully thought out by the individual, by the practitioner, by the family. It's not a decision that's taken lightly, and it's in some ways sort of like the last option. You know, if the person feels I truly cannot be myself this way, and these are the reasons why, these are all the activities I cannot perform. A good example would be someone can't go swimming, someone can't work out because they're binding all the time and they can hardly breathe under that situation. There are many sort of anecdotes that I could give that sort of back up why this could be very detrimental, but it's never a decision that's taken lightly. In terms of when is the right time, I think that's highly variable, just because it's each individual has a very different path with this. There are some folks who come and see me and they want no medical intervention, like at all, but they do consider themselves transgender, and they are, and they want certain pronouns used, and they live their life that way and are very happy as long as people respect their wishes. And then you have another individual who only wants hormones and that's perfectly fine. And yet we also have people who their life will not be quite right until we address whatever the sexual characteristic is that can't be changed by a hormone therapy.
Erin, I see you nodding.
Yes. Everything that Leo just said was exactly the conversation I had with my doctor, Dr. Rachel Inker. And I had really what struck me that Leo said was there are literally activities that you cannot do because it is too uncomfortable or because, you know, with a binder, I am a singer. When I would bind at school and then go into chorus, like I would sometimes have to like sit down and just like breathe because it's really constricting and, you know, it covers more than just your chest area. It's the entire rib cage. And, you know, the ribs are pretty important for breathing. Mm-hmm. And as a singer, you know, you're supposed to really be expanding that to get in as much air as possible. And it was very difficult for me. And also, like, you know, gym class and, you know, just being a normal teen in the summer was very hard for me until I got this surgery. Just being invited to the beach was actually really emotional for me because of like some of my closest friends would be like, Erin, like we're going to go have fun at like North Beach. Like, come with us. Like, we'll give you a ride. You know, they would really be trying to include me because they knew that it was difficult for me, but I was never able to say yes. Cause it's just, there's real cognitive dissonance, in trying to present yourself in a way that you know other people can't see without you telling them.
We got a note from Karen in Elmore who says, as a parent of a transgender teen, I can't give enough praise for the trans youth program caregivers at UVM. Dr. Gibson, that's Dr. Erica Gibson, a pediatrician at UVM's Children's Hospital and medical director of the transgender youth program. Dr. Gibson has been so supportive and helpful. We're talking with Leo Klein, a nurse practitioner working at the BU Clinic at the Community Health Centers of Burlington, and Erin Young, a senior at South Burlington High School, who's sharing his own experiences with this. And let's go to Ellen, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Ellen. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Thanks for having me. This is an access issue, and my daughter was older at the time. She had Vermont Medicaid. And there's no surgeon in Vermont for male-to-female gender affirmation surgery or at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, even to this time. And surgeons we contacted, you know, in Pennsylvania and San Francisco do not accept Vermont Medicaid. So there aren't any surgeons who accept Vermont Medicaid for that type of surgery that I know of.
So, Ellen, it's been really difficult for your daughter to access care?
Yes.
Well, I appreciate hearing that and hearing your perspective. Leo Klein, what do you think? I mean, what about that question of actually finding a surgeon who can do the surgery that you need here in Vermont?
It's an excellent question. Thanks for bringing that up, Ellen. It's a source of a lot of strain and stress for many of my patients. Locally, we have pretty good access for trans men who need a mastectomy. But when you go beyond that, trans women can also get augmentation here, although that is a little bit more difficult to get that approved. When it comes to genital surgeries, there are very few options that are doable for most people in terms of travel and expense. Just to make it to a surgeon's place for a consult, let's say. So if you're flying to the West Coast and then you're having to spend money to stay there, to find somebody who's actually experienced and available with our insurance options, it's very difficult. We have recently had a contract made with the surgeon that is down in Pennsylvania, Dr. Roomer, and we're starting to build that, but it is definitely a very big issue. And all we can do is continue to advocate for these specific surgeons to do a contract with Vermont Medicaid, because from my understanding, Vermont Medicaid is open to the idea of doing this for patients, and they understand that we don't offer it locally. But that the surgeon who is accepting the insurance has to be willing to do that extra homework and credentialing and all that.
And let's go to Elena calling in from Montpelier. Elena, hi. What's your perspective?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So it's something different, but I do want to continue that comment. Having some experience working for Vermont Medicaid on a couple of different levels, both for provider services and for patient services, Vermont Medicaid simply does not pay that much money. Many surgeons will not accept the amount of money that Vermont Medicaid is willing to pay for these surgeries. So I'm sure it's gotten brought up in the program already, but a simple solution to that would be a single-payer healthcare system that everybody's paying into so we can all collectively afford more. My other actual comment that I'd like to make had to do with parts of the conversation that I feel might benefit if we were a little bit more specific. Instead of saying gender-confirming surgery or gender-affirming surgery, to pluralize that, because there are actually a lot of different surgeries that are considered by a lot of insurance companies, both private and public, or private and, like Medicaid and Medicare, that they consider them to be not medically necessary or cosmetic in nature, and then are pretty much denied outright for a lot of trans people. So, that could include, we could talk about it the way I think most people are probably assuming to be bottom surgery is what we're talking about. But there's also, as Leo had pointed out, there's top surgeries for both trans men and trans women and non-binary people. And there's facial feminization surgery for trans women or trans feminine people. And all of the things that kind of like alter people's secondary sex characteristics, including the face, are probably a lot more, they have a larger effect, I would say, on how a person is perceived in society, which would probably mean for better health outcomes for trans people in general. Hopefully that information helps the conversation a little bit. Thanks for taking my call.
Elena, I really appreciate that perspective and you adding some of the specifics, as you mentioned, about different types of surgeries. I mean, we sort of are using that umbrella term. And this question of, okay, well, exactly what does that mean and what types of surgeries and what kinds of surgeries are going to be covered by insurance companies, what's deemed medically necessary and what's not. Let's get one more comment in here before we go to another guest. Diane is on the line with us from Montreal. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Good. Just calling because we're American and we moved to Montreal 7 years ago. And we have a 17-year-old female-to-male son who came out 4 years ago. And it's been a really interesting experience for us navigating the Canadian healthcare system and having friends in the U.S. Who have been navigating the U.S. system. So female-to-male for my son, all of the treatments have been covered under, I know that that socialized medicine and governmental health care is a big topic. Everything has been covered here through the government thus far. So all of the hormone treatment, all of the doctor treatments, or all of the doctor visits, and top surgery, which is coming up, is also covered under the government plan here. So super interesting. And what's been interesting for us is, as you navigate this, I think people are talking about it so much more than they did just 4 years ago when we started on this. We didn't know anybody who was transgender, and you didn't hear much talked about. And we were the first for a lot of people. We were the first for our pharmacist. We were the first for our primary care physician. We were the first family for, every step of the way. But it's been a super supportive environment as people have wanted to listen and learn about how to treat and take care of a transgender kid and their family.
Well, Diane, I appreciate your perspective and sharing it, both a Canadian perspective and a parent's perspective. We're talking about gender-affirming care, medical care for young people in Vermont who are trans or non-binary. And let's also invite Allison Lyne Andrews into the conversation. She's a therapist in private practice working with LGBTQ patients at practices in Wells River, White River Junction, and St. Johnsbury. Allison, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm curious about your perspective on this, but also your perspective on young people trying to access care, medical care of all kinds, including mental health care, who are not necessarily either near one of the big hospitals in or near Vermont or, near a population center. Do you find it different?
So I have worked with patients that come down from Newport. And they have to go all the way down to Dartmouth for an initial endocrinology appointment. And then from there, their PCP can take over the treatment. But they do go back down to their transgender clinic at least, you know, once a month. The trans clinic is once a month, and so they will have to coordinate their appointments to go down there when they need to.
You know, we got a note from Jonathan in Norwich who says, as the parent of a non-binary child, I'd like to emphasize that care for non-binary youth can be very different from care for trans youth. Our child had a difficult time finding providers who really understood their experience and what would be right for them. Several providers with lengthy experience working with trans patients simply didn't get the differences our child had from other patients. After numerous false starts, we eventually found excellent care with the CATCH program at Boston Medical Center. Allison, what do you think about, I mean, the sort of big umbrella terms we're using, but then the really different types of ways that people see themselves and then therefore the care they might need?
So I can understand why that is sort of, that's difficult for some providers. You know, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around having, you know, a young person come in and say that they're not either male or female. I mean, or that they're both, or that it changes. I mean, it's just kind of hard to wrap your head around that. What I will always sort of default to is, well, what is the child saying? You know, let them decide. Let them tell me. Let them educate me. Or that just to recognize that there are times in everyone's life when you forget identification. You know, you forget, okay, yeah, all day I didn't think that I was a woman. And so that's what it's like, you know, that you aren't constantly thinking about one or the other.
Leo Klein, how do you deal with that kind of question that we got from Jonathan saying, you know, my child really struggled to get the care that they needed because even their medical professionals wanted to put them into the binary?
Mm-hmm. I would say that it's definitely a burgeoning population. I think children younger and younger ages are now experimenting more with gender fluidity, and it's healthy to do that. And it doesn't mean that that's going to result in people choosing things that don't align with who they are. It means that there's more expression, there's more sort of exploration of who these kids are. And so we should all, as providers, be more comfortable using they-them pronouns, encouraging people to talk about the different ways they experience their gender identity. And I think if we're able to do that, it means that we're going to have patients being more appropriately cared for and allocating services that actually address whatever that individual's needs are. So I would encourage people to think of gender non-binary youth as needing the same level of support as somebody who very clearly identifies as transgender. And that support might even involve doing a surgery. It might involve doing hormones, but they still may not say that they are male or female. And we need to all work to become really expansive in our understanding of gender identity. And it's a beautiful world when you start to do that.
Todd's calling in from Shrewsbury. Hi, Todd. What's your perspective?
Good afternoon, Jane. Well, my perspective is a little bit less than positive on a couple of specific fronts that have been part of the conversation. I've long had concerns over any gender reassignment surgery when it comes to children. You know, the research that I did some years ago on gender dysphoria seemed to indicate that gender fluidity is common among youngsters and often self-resolves over time. So, you know, to perform surgery, life-altering permanent surgery, on a person who is not yet necessarily stable in their sexual identity, I think poses great risks. To go further, there's a strong gender dysphoria bears a strong resemblance to another psychological disturbance. And when I say these things, I mean the greatest respect for anyone who's struggling with these issues. I mean, no harm whatsoever. But gender dysphoria bears a striking resemblance in some regards to body dysmorphic disorder, which I can't imagine that if a child presented with body dysmorphic disorder and suggested that they wanted, for example, a leg removed because they were unhappy with it. I don't think most people would say, yes, I think we should just go ahead and remove that limb.
So, Todd, I want to add to your perspective here a couple other listeners that we've gotten and then bring this back to Leo Klein because we're short on time. But so Mike expressed some ambivalence about the question of whether young people should be getting surgery and says, I'm all for the counseling and puberty blockers until they're 18. The changes in the human body that they go through during that time are irreversible without surgery and can make passing way tougher if they're allowed to occur. So Mike appreciates the idea of these blockers, but is unsure about surgery. And then two listeners wrote in to ask about these ethical ramifications of providing surgery in a similar way to what Todd was saying. Alco Freebus tweets, we shouldn't be experimenting on children with irreversible procedures. And Tom mentions the fact that the human brain continues to develop until someone is in their mid-20s and wonders about trans kids who might change their mind. Tom writes, is this not child abuse? So, Leo, how do you think about this question of surgery specifically for young people, which I think a lot of listeners are coming back to?
Sure. So there was a term used there that I have to disagree with, which was that surgeons or providers are experimenting on children. That is certainly not happening, just to be absolutely clear. What happens is that a young person would come in and there would be a very thorough discussion on numerous occasions with the child, with the family, with the therapist. It is nothing that anyone is rushing into, and it typically takes years before the discussion around surgery is really on the table. So I sort of refute the idea that this is something that is willy-nilly decided randomly, and then, you know, someone is just going into this without a really informed consent from everyone involved. And the second thing I would say is just that we don't want to unnecessarily delay treatment to somebody who may be at pretty severe risk. And I can't really underline that enough. If you wanted to investigate some of the harm that happens from delaying treatment, it's readily available.
Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, just to give kind of an anecdotal timeline to what Leo's talking about, I first went to see a doctor for my trans healthcare when I was 14. I didn't start hormones until I was 15. And, you know, surgery was just a couple months ago. It's definitely an ongoing conversation. You're always talking to your doctor about, does this still feel right? Do you still like the plan that we have? You know, it's definitely very methodically thought out, and you are always talking about it, always trying to make sure that it's really what you want. And, you know, if it's...
Yeah. That's Aaron Young, a senior at South Burlington High School. Aaron, I appreciate you sharing your perspective and your own experiences with us. That's difficult to do. Thank you.
For sure. Thank you for having me.
Leo Klein is a nurse practitioner working at the BU Clinic at the Community Health Centers of Burlington. Leo, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much.
And Allison Lyne Andrews is a therapist in private practice working with LGBTQ patients at practices in Wells River, White River Junction, and St. Johnsbury. Allison, thanks very much to you as well.
Thank you for having me.